Welcome to Moolala, Money Made Simple on SiriusXM. Here's your host, Bruce Sellery.
Hello, I'm Bruce Sellery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Coming up on the program this week, stuck in the vice of debt. Filing for bankruptcy isn't your only option. Doug Hoyes, licensed insolvency trustee at Hoyes, Michaelos & Associates, will be here to take us through all the different alternatives. Then all the insurance policies out there would take you forever to go through. Literally, it is insanely complex. Policy Advisor is a new service that can help you choose the best plan for you. It's one of a number of new sites popping out there hoping to disrupt and innovate in the industry. We'll talk to Jiten Puri, the CEO of Policy Advisor, to find out how it works. And wishful thinking. Maybe, just maybe, you're going to get a bonus this year. But if you do, what should you do with it? Jeremy Straub is the CEO of Coastal Wealth, and he's here with some advice. And we'll talk to Aurel Crissell from IG Wealth Management about old age security and how to minimize clawbacks. And FP Canada's Carrie List on the decade ahead, what to expect in the financial advice industry. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by EQ Bank. Banking simplified. Let's get started. Sometimes people can't pay back their debt. Not like, oh, I can only pay my minimum this month. More like, I literally can't pay my debts off, like, ever. In this case, a bankruptcy filing is something you might need to consider. But it isn't the only option. Doug Hoyes is a licensed insolvency trustee at Hoyes, Michaelos & Associates. He joins us now. Hello there.
Great to be with you, Bruce.
There are different degrees of debt. What would you tell, what would tell you that a client needs to seriously think about more than just eating ramen noodles for a month?
Well, if you take a look at how long it's going to take you to pay it back, and it's, you know, it says right on your credit card statement, if you make the minimum payment, it's going to be 242 years, then right. I would say you've got too much debt. So rule of thumb, if it's going to take you, I don't know, more than 5 years of, you know, trying to service it, then, well, maybe you've got more of a debt problem than you can deal with on your own.
Now, people throw around the term bankruptcy all the time and don't have a real clear sense of what it actually is. We will talk about that. But before we do, I think we should talk about the one that is a viable option that people don't know as much about, and that's the consumer proposal. So what is it and how is it different from filing for bankruptcy?
It's a deal. So that's the real short.
It's a deal. Let's make a deal.
One word
Monty
answer.
Hall.
It's a deal. So in a bankruptcy, you lose your stuff. There are certain obligations. We can talk about all that. In a consumer proposal, we go to all the people you owe money to and we say, look, I can't pay it in full, but I can pay a portion. Let's make a deal. So perhaps the deal will be I'll pay $300 a month for the next 5 years or something like that. Right. That's not the full amount owing, but they agree to take that and wipe out the rest.
Now, it's negotiated. How much latitude is there to negotiate? Can I say, how about 5 cents on the dollar?
You can.
Does it work for you?
They'll probably say no. So Right. We figure out how much they would get in a bankruptcy. Well, we got to offer them more than that or else there's no incentive to take it.
Right.
And so having done this a few tens of thousands of times, we got a pretty good idea of what they're looking for. Because let's face it, we're dealing with the big banks, the big credit card companies. It's the same guys all the time, right? Or CRA. So we figure out what's reasonable, what you can afford, what they're likely to accept. That's the deal that we offer them. There is then a voting period where they get to vote. And if they say yes, fantastic. If not, then that does trigger a negotiating period after that.
What are the pros and cons versus a bankruptcy filing to
well,
a consumer proposal?
The big pro is you know exactly what you've got to pay. In a bankruptcy, the amount you pay is based on your income. It goes up and down every month. So with a consumer proposal, it's locked in. I work some overtime. I get a bonus. No problem. I still know what I have to pay. So it's locked in. And usually the monthly payment is less because we're dragging it out over an extended period of time.
Right.
So a bankruptcy can last for 9 months, 21 months, depends on your situation. With a consumer proposal, it can be up to 5 years. So maybe instead of a bankruptcy being $400 or $500 a month for a shorter period of time, a consumer proposal could be $200 a month over 5 years, that sort of thing.
And how does it connect to credit score? I wasn't going to say how does it impact your credit score, because if you're filing for a consumer proposal, you may not have a great credit score.
That's the key point. You're already in big trouble.
Yeah.
So this is going to make it better. So there's a note that stays on your credit report for 3 years after the proposal is completed, or a maximum of 6 years. It gets knocked off after 6 years, that says you filed a consumer proposal. So notionally, that's an R7. A bankruptcy is an R9. Perfect credit is an R1. So it's not as bad is a bankruptcy. But you've dealt with all your debt. Sooner you get it paid off, sooner it comes off your credit report and you can start the rebuilding process.
So then by as point of comparison, what's it mean to file for bankruptcy?
In a bankruptcy, you are surrendering the assets that you have, and most people who come to see me don't have any, or else they would have sold their assets to, right, to deal with it. The big kicker is that the payment is based on your income. So every month you're sending me your pay stubs, the government sets a limit. If you're over that limit, you've got to pay extra. So if you're in a situation where you think your situation is going to get better, I'm going to start getting some overtime, maybe I'm getting a new job, maybe I'm going to pick up a second job, then bankruptcy can become very expensive. So with a consumer proposal, we lock it in based on your situation today. It doesn't change.
What happens for those people who are in a relationship? Does the spouse get taken down with them in either of these two, or does it differ?
No, they're both the same. The debts that you have are what are included in the process. So the fact that my spouse has debts has no impact on my filing, unless, of course, we've co-sign them if they're joint debts, then if I file a proposal, the bank might be happy with me, but they can still go after my spouse. So if you have a spouse and there are joint debts, you want to talk to your licensed insolvency trustee about that to make sure we've considered what the impact would be.
There's also something called debt settlement. You have a huge degree of skepticism about that as a path, and I'm sure informed by the fact that you're a licensed insolvency trustee, people who do that aren't that.
Yes, but there's also government rules that make it very prohibitive. It used to be that there were these debt settlement companies that say, no problem, Bruce, we can deal with your debts. Give us a couple of grand, we'll deal with it. The government realized that people were charging big upfront fees for doing nothing, so they put a kibosh on that, which is good. With a debt settlement, you are negotiating a separate deal with every individual creditor. With a consumer proposal, we're doing it all for one. In a consumer proposal, one vote per dollar owed. If more than half say yes, it's binding on everyone. Mm. Whereas with a debt settlement, you got to get everyone to agree. So what if you can get 9 out of 10 to agree, but the 10th guy decides to take you to court and garnish your wages? You're right. Pooched. So debt settlement only works with a very limited number of creditors. And if you've got a lump sum you can throw on the table. If you've got some debt from 2 years ago, yeah, they'll probably accept 20 cents on the dollar right off the bat. But since most people aren't in that situation, the consumer proposal is almost always a better option.
There is a very strong network in this country for nonprofit credit counselors. Should an individual start there? What role do they play?
Well, they do debt management plans, okay, which is like a consumer proposal, only you are paying the debts back in full. There's no discount. They can get a break on the interest, but you're still paying the full amount owing. And it is not legally binding on every single creditor. So again, if 9 out of 10 agree, you can still have one that doesn't agree. Debt management plans through a not-for-profit credit counselor aren't going to bind Revenue Canada, CRA, for example. So if you've got tax debts, that's not going to work. If you've already got a judgment against you, a wage garnishment, more difficult to get that stopped, whereas it's automatic in a consumer proposal. So you're right. You said it earlier. I'm biased. I believe, you know, come talk to us. If another professional is a better one for you to see, then we're gonna refer you there.
Because I guess one of the advantages, and typically you can work in concert, but one of the benefits is they provide some counseling to ensure to reduce the risk that you're going to get into the situation again.
Yeah, and that's a critical point. And so if you're dealing with a not-for-profit counselor, ask them, how much in-person counseling can I get? Because a lot of them now are call centers. You're dealing with someone on the phone, you never talk to one.
Right.
If you file a consumer proposal, there are two in-person bankruptcy and insolvency counseling sessions you're going to have with either myself or one of our licensed counselors. So there is counseling as part of the consumer proposal process as well.
You cannot ride public transit these days without seeing ads related to debt. A whole bunch of different ads, and I'm sure some are licensed insolvency trustees like you, some aren't. How do you determine what is real and what isn't real? What are the warning signs that you see when you see those ads out there?
Well, number one, upfront fees, because a licensed insolvency trustee is not allowed to charge an upfront fee. We don't start getting paid until the process is actually filed. Are they registered by the government? Are they actually licensed? So it's pretty simple. You can phone the guys in the ads and say, hey, are you licensed by the federal government or not? That's a very good first step.
You and your people take calls every single day from people who are in really, really tough circumstances. What is the single most common thing you say to people in that first call that we're now going to tell all of our listeners so when they call you, they'll be able to get to question two and you can save yourself 4 minutes?
You're not alone. You know, it's very embarrassing. I'm the only one in this situation. I, you know, didn't want to make this call.
Right.
Well, in Canada this year, in 2020, there will probably be something like 135,000, 140,000 consumer proposals and bankruptcies filed.
Say that number again.
Somewhere between 130,000, 140,000.
Wow.
In Canada. So, and that's not the peak. In 2009, it was over 150,000. So you are not alone. And those are the people who are in such dire shape that they have to do something. That's not people who have debt. That's pretty much everybody, right? So doing nothing isn't going to make debt go away. That's not the way compounding interest works, right? It can work both ways. So in most cases, you're better off talking to someone, figuring out what the solution is right away.
Thank you very much, Doug. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Bruce.
Doug Hoyes, licensed insolvency trustee at Hoyes, Michalos & Associates. Our conversation was all about dealing with debt. There are options out there.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Buying insurance can be a complicated process and loathsome process, by the way. It's like not one of my favorite things to do. But there are so many different kinds and policies and clauses, blah, blah, blah. It can be very difficult to choose one that fits your specific needs. Policy Advisor is a relatively new service online, and it is trying to help people find an insurance policy that is a great fit. Jiten Puri is Policy Advisor's CEO. He is here to tell us how it works. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Now, you are working in Manhattan. You are working in New York. You're an investment banker. You're working with insurance companies. You saw a need. You decided to throw that life to the wayside and become an entrepreneur. Are you crazy? Did you buy all the insurance that you would need to, in order to make sure you were stable as you walked down this entrepreneurial path?
Bruce, I do look back at that time and wonder why I did what I did. But to be honest, super excited with the decision that I made. In my previous role, as you picked up on, I was advising some of the largest financial institutions, particularly banks and insurance companies, on the advent of technology and how that was disrupting their businesses. In advising the insurance companies, I realized the challenges that they were facing were pretty much the same. The distribution force was aging. The consumer was not engaging with their products. The consumer wanted to go digital, but the distributors weren't ready to go digital. And that's where I felt there was an opportunity.
So what is Policy Advisor?
So Policy Advisor is a insurance marketplace, a digital-first insurance marketplace that is making it radically simple, transparent, and accessible for Canadians to be able to purchase life insurance and other related products. We launched in 2019, and we currently partner with 20 of the largest insurance companies in Canada to provide easy access to their insurance products to consumers here.
How would you describe, and I'm sure I'm oversimplifying the question, or maybe my naivete will show here, are you a broker or are you a comparison site?
So we are a broker, and thanks for suggesting me to bring out that difference and that nuance. Price comparison sites have done a terrific job 10 years ago in helping discover different quotes and different prices. We go way beyond that. We provide end-to-end fulfillment, so starting from educating the consumer about different insurance products that exist, helping them engage with those products through calculators and tools, and last but not the least, we help fulfill those sales and those purchases for the consumers as well.
What happens when there is a claim? What is Policy Advisor's role? And I ask because, and I've told this story on the air before, I had a household claim when I lived in Calgary. It was a disaster. And a broker told me afterwards, it's like, well, you didn't have a broker. Why did you book direct? Of course it was a nightmare. You're an online platform, and for some consumers like me, that feels the same as direct, and therefore there's no human being, there's no person. How does a claim unfold in your model?
So from our perspective, we are advisors. The reason we added advisor in our name is because we want consumers to see us as such. So anytime they need to interact with the insurance companies, and they always have direct access to the insurance companies, we want them to speak with us because we will be able to help facilitate those claims or any other changes that they want to make within their policies on an ongoing basis for them. So we provide not just online tools, but we supplement human expertise, and we bring about real-world expertise to the consumer as well.
Now, your experience starts with something called your insurance checkup,
which
I did. Tell people how it works, simply.
So the insurance checkup is a very holistic view for the consumer to understand how insurance products evolve and how their needs evolve and how, based on their lifestyle, they should be looking at different products to service different needs. We help the Canadian consumer understand what gaps exist in their insurance portfolios. We then identify for them products, and we then help them choose those products from across hundreds of different products that are available in the market.
So I did the insurance checkup, and it got it wrong for me. So I'll tell you what I mean.
Sure.
It said my risk was high based on the circumstances. And the two products it recommended were critical illness insurance, which is restrictive and not worth the cost, and mortgage insurance, which compared to term insurance, in my view, is not a great option. Term insurance is cheaper. You're not insuring a declining liability, all those reasons. So do you need to fix your algorithm, or am I an anomaly, or have I just illuminated a weakness in your business that you will heretofore correct?
Bruce, thank you for bringing that up, because that's where our real-world expertise comes in. Mortgage insurance is a misnomer, and you rightly pointed that out. A lot of consumers end up purchasing mortgage insurance when they should be purchasing term insurance, and that's what our site does. What you see notified as mortgage insurance on the site is really a term insurance product. If you had given us the opportunity to take you through the process, you would have seen that we very strongly endorse term insurance as the right alternative to mortgage insurance. So if we see you have a mortgage, we would suggest for you to get coverage and protect your family towards the loan that may be on you. But we help you do that by acquiring term insurance.
I also went through the life insurance tool, and it asked if I had a child and if I was going to pay for the education, but it didn't ask if I'd been saving for an RESP. So the insurance accounted for the fact that I wanted to pay for college, but it shouldn't, because I've got that covered.
Bruce, absolutely. And so we do ask you if you have savings and investments in our calculator and make that adjustment should you have savings and investments. Indulge us, because we've also created a relatively simplistic tool to try and help consumers understand different variables that go into it. The consumer is never purchasing insurance fully online. Our advisors then get involved and help the consumer think through nuances that you are rightly highlighting. So for instance, if you have an RESP, we would like you to capture in the savings and assets that you already have in the calculator. But should you not have done that, our advisors, when we speak with you, will help facilitate that.
So if I have proceeded, and there was a whole way to do that I chose not to do, I would have been connected to a person, correct?
Absolutely.
Why would I go to a person who I discovered digitally instead of saying to my Facebook community, hey, give me an insurance broker that you love, 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 love? Why would I go with a stranger versus getting a referral from someone who I know and trust?
Bruce, so various things. First and foremost, the ease of access. In trying to identify who that advisor would be that you would be willing to trust, that in itself will take you a few days to a few weeks.
I have very good Facebook friends. They would give me very good recommendations.
Your friends are fantastic. The advisors may not have availability to get in touch with you and be available right in front of you when you need them to be. And that's where we come in. What typically takes weeks and months to be able to purchase, we are now solving that pain point by helping consumers get insured in hours, sometimes minutes as well. And so that's the biggest change we're bringing about. Two, we also have the widest access. Most of the advisors that you would speak with would typically be selling one to two to three insurance companies. Beyond that, it's hard for them to carry a catalog larger than that. We provide access to 20 different insurance companies instantly to the consumer. We are unbiased. We are completely independent. We are not owned by any of the insurance companies. Our advisors aren't even commission-based. They're completely salaried. So we are able to provide you instant, independent, and highly curated advice that may have taken you a lot longer if you went the traditional brick-and-mortar route.
How do you make your money? Same as any other brokerage? You just, your gateway is the web?
On an overall brokerage, yes. We get paid commissions by the insurance companies. We never charge our consumers now or in the future for any advice that we provide to them. So commissions is how we earn from the insurance companies. But at the same time, we're not incentivized in selling bigger policies, because our advisors are fully salaried and therefore they can work in the best interests of the consumer.
How in your training of those folks do you ensure that they don't overinsure? And I take your caveat around what your website delivered and offered up insurance that I do not want and don't believe in. How do you ensure that your people don't do that? Because at some level, you need to sell a big book of business.
Absolutely, Bruce. And that's where, you know, we are different. We're different from how traditional advisors have been. There is an audit trail that gets created for every single client interaction that we have. Our advisors get audited by us internally. Every single client that goes through and purchases a policy through us, there's a trail that gets created off the calculators that we help them look at, how we advise and help them refine their choices. And that gets reviewed quite regularly.
Interesting stuff. Well, thank you for endeavoring to provide some innovation in insurance. It seems like the last bastion of archaic business practices. So if you can do anything on that front, we're grateful.
Thanks, Bruce. And there's much more coming.
I bet there is. Jiten Puri is the CEO of Policy Advisor. That's interesting. Check it out. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by EQ Bank. They are a digital banking platform launched back in 2016 by Equitable Bank, which has actually been around for decades. EQ Bank provides state-of-the-art digital banking services. Now, one of the things that Canadians talk a lot about is bank fees. Well, they have something called the EQ Bank Savings Plus account that pays an everyday 2.3% interest rate and also has the flexibility of a checking account. So it's got unlimited transactions, no everyday banking fees, no minimum balances, fast, cheap, and interestingly, fully transparent on international money transfers, all from one account. EQ Bank, thank you for your support of the show. Now, coming up next on Moolala, if you're expecting a bonus, Jeremy Straub will be here to share his tips on what you should and shouldn't do with it. And if you aren't expecting one, let's live vicariously, shall we? Then later, we'll talk to Carrie List from FP Canada about the decade ahead in the financial advice industry. Now, if you want more Moolala, you can go to our website, moolala.ca. And if you go to the podcast tab, you can actually search specific topics you're interested in. All our archives are carved up into 8-minute segments, so you can listen only to the ones that are relevant to you right now. Now, while you're at the website, you can sign up for the Moolala newsletter. It brings together all the fun stuff that I do over the course of the month. This show, another show I host called Prosper, the Financial Advisors Podcast, plus my columns from CBC Radio, Cityline, and Yahoo Finance. Only comes once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address other than send you that newsletter. Stick around. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
I haven't gotten a year-end bonus in forever. That's kind of the thing when you're an entrepreneur. But I do like to dream about getting one. So let's do that together. Let's dream together. If we were to get a bonus, what could we do with it? What should we do with it? What would we do with it? Jeremy Straub is the CEO of Coastal Wealth. He's got some do's and don'ts for the bonus. He's in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hello there.
How you doing, Bruce?
When you say bonus, what do you mean? Are we talking like enough to buy a cheap home use drone, or are we talking Club Meg Extapa for 2 weeks with a room upgrade?
Well, I guess it depends on the role that you're in and the compensation package you have, but it could be anywhere from a $3,000 year-end bonus. It might be 2 to 4 weeks of your salary to 60-70% of your income, depending on what type of job you're in.
Yeah. Now, what are some of the questions that you believe individuals should ask themselves before they do anything? And I'm supposing you recommend people take a minute to pause before they push by on some extravagant African safari or something like that.
I would agree with that. So in general, your bonus, you should have that it's not there to help you pay normal cash flow, but it's an extra money that you're there because you never know if it's going to happen or not, and your employer is going to pay the dollar amount you thought. So this should be extra money you can use for certain things. I always recommend first looking at paying off debt. If there's bad debt, especially with high interest rates, that's one of the first areas you want to get to. You have credit cards paying 10-20%. You're never going to make that in the market guaranteed. You're better off paying off some debt.
Okay. What's number two? What's idea number two?
Well, I would think about starting to split money. What I always recommend for people is you got to keep some money for fun, but in general, you should save about half of it. And then the other half, decide between charity and decide between celebrating a little bit. You know, you had a good year. There's a reward for the year, whether it's a little bit of money towards your vacation or might be something you've been looking and eyeing up for a while and a little gift to yourself. But I would make sure you save at least half of it first before you do that.
And so on that saves, or let's say save slash invest, we've got debt first. What are the other elements here, and how do you think through which is most advantageous? So top of mind would be, I don't know, saving for retirement, saving for kids' education, saving for a new car, down payment on a property. How do you prioritize those various ideas?
So bad debt first. I say bad debt because a mortgage could be considered good debt depending on your interest rate and its deductibility. So bad debt with high interest rates. Your second area you want to save is something that you might not be able to take loans for later. So if you're saving for a kid's school, you can actually take student loans to help do that. You can't take loans for retirement. So my suggestion as always is to save for retirement first. When it comes to retirement, there's a lot of tax favored investments that you can look at.
Yeah, and the Canadian dynamic is different than the U.S., but we do have a way to defer income tax on that through the RSP.
True. Yeah. So retirement I would do first, then opposed to saving for an education if you have the choice.
And then what about down payment or saving for a car?
So it's the same thing. If you're saving for a new car, my suggestion is you have about 3 to 6 months of your expenses set aside in a cash reserve. So add up all your expenses, and you should have about 3 to 6 months sitting in cash. That's the first place you go before you start investing for the future. If you have that 6 month savings, the next step is then start going for something you might want, like a home or a car would be a good example. And that's where you might start saving to next.
Why do you advocate for such a high level in an emergency fund? You're not alone. I mean, many, many, many people believe that having an emergency fund that's, 3 to 6 months of salary is appropriate. It's just an enormous sum of money to be sitting there doing nothing, especially if you have a spouse who works or access to a credit line at, prime plus one, that if you were to run into trouble, if you were to lose your job, you would have other ways to keep a roof over your head.
So if you have an access to a home equity line of credit or some other line of credit, many people will consider that as part of their cash reserve, which I think you can rationalize to have less money sitting in cash. But it really comes down to a comfort level. In a low unemployment rate environment, you might not find the job you want right away. And so you might not want to take an opportunity quickly. Along with that, you never know expenses that might be more than you wanted. So for example, if insurance didn't cover something for a month or 2 months on a house as you waited for a claim, you don't want to tap into credit. You might want to actually use cash to be able to do that. So having that cash, I found, is though you can argue it might not make financial sense, the level of peace of mind it gives clients and allows them to sleep at night, I found that 3 to 6 months is a good spot to be in where they feel most comfortable.
Yeah. Some of our listeners are in the debt reduction category and they're like, oh yeah, that's a nice fantasy because I got, $4,200 outstanding on my credit card. Let me segue to a big picture question. And that is this: how do you balance the financial rationale of what to spend this bonus on with the emotional rationale? Simply put, I should pay off my credit cards, but I feel like a vacation.
Well, I think that's something that most people wrestle with. What I always found is having somebody that has an unbiased opinion to be able to be kind of a coach or a counselor to do it.
Yeah.
Financial advisor, financial planner, that you have to just talk through it. Because if you get the money, you see it in your checking account, the first thing you want to do is go out and buy something. And so the more you can have regular scheduled meetings with your financial planner or financial advisor allows you the opportunity to take a step back before you make any irrational decision.
I am sure you have some clients who are in relationships, happy or otherwise. How do you encourage spouses to talk this through? Because I think it's probably fair to say that sometimes it's one spouse that gets the bonus and they have to navigate, who gets the veto, how are you going to set priorities, that kind of stuff.
Just keep separate checking accounts and don't tell them about the bonus.
So how have you been enjoying your divorced period, Jeremy? Is that going well for you?
Luckily, I'm happily married.
All right. Yeah. For about 5 more minutes, I think, after your spouse listens to this.
That's right. I think one of the major reasons for divorce is over financial arguments. And so the more transparent you are ahead of time before it comes and making a decision before the money hits your account, the more likely that'll stop the arguments in the future. So typically this should be something that's happening. And this is where if you have a financial advisor or even just the time for you and your spouse to sit down on a quarterly, a semi-annual basis and talk about your financials, you already have a plan in place of what you might be thinking about that bonus. Then opposed to spouse sees the money in the checking account.
We're rich. We're rich.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So just like any healthy relationship, it's about communication and frequent communication.
All right. Well, good luck with that at home and with your clients and all that. I'm just teasing. Jeremy, thanks for your time and your insight.
All right. I enjoyed it. Have a great day.
Jeremy Straub, CEO of Coastal Wealth. He was here to talk about the year-end bonus. For those of you who get them, some practical insight. For those of you who don't, some aspirational insight. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, we'll talk to Urel Crissell of IG Wealth Management about old age security and how to minimize clawbacks. What a horrible phrase, by the way, old age security. They need to rebrand that. It's like, I don't know, some other thing. Shouldn't be that. Groovy senior bonus, something. And later, Policy Advisors Jitin Puri is back for the Moolala questionnaire. Hey, if you want to join in the conversation, send us a note. Please do. Old school. Email at moolala.ca or on social, Twitter at Bruce Selry, Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala. Stay with us.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are plenty of things to consider while coming up with a solid retirement plan. Understanding some of the benefits out there for Canadians is a pretty good start. One of these benefits is old age security. Urel Crissell is Assistant Vice President of Tax and Estate Planning at IG Wealth Management. He's here to explain the government benefit and, in particular, how to minimize clawbacks, which, of course, make people crazy. Hello there.
Hello.
I am about 30,000 years away from this being relevant to me because I'm the ripe old age of I'm not telling you. What is old age security and who gets it?
Old age security is a federal government benefit, and it is paid by the federal government to individuals who meet certain criteria. The first criteria is you have to be at least 65 years of age or older. You also have to be a Canadian citizen or a legal resident, and you have to meet certain residency requirements. So essentially, you have to have resided in Canada for at least 10 years since the age of 18. That will get you into some benefits under the old age security program. To get maximum benefits, then you must have lived in Canada essentially for 40 years. Right. If you've lived between 40 and 10 years since you've been the age of 18, you'll get a prorated benefit. So you'll get something. You just won't get the full benefit.
And different versus CPP in that CPP is connected to income, to what you paid into the Canada Pension Plan over the years, correct?
Correct. Correct. CPP and QPP, for that matter, for individuals in Quebec, is a contributory system, so the individuals contribute to the plan, and in return, they will receive benefits upon their retirement. They can usually age 65, it could be as early as 60, or it could be as late as 70. The OAS program, however, is completely funded by general government revenue. There's no contributions that are made. You can start at 65. You can actually defer OAS until you're 70 if you wish. That's an option. And if you defer, you actually get more, so you get 0.6% bonus per month that you defer all the way to age 70. So you could get up to 36% more than you would have received at age 65 if you defer. That's a choice you can make.
Now, give us the range here. I mean, this is not, you are not wintering in Saint-Tropez on your OAS payment. What's the maximum amount?
This alone, no. The amounts are indexed quarterly. So, for example, from January 1st to March 31st of this year, the monthly payment is $613.53.
Right. So it's not a huge amount of money.
It's not a huge amount of money. It certainly helps. And it's income tested. So you're not guaranteed to receive it if you're making what the government would consider to be too much money. And so essentially for 2020, the floor has been set at just above $79,000. So if you're making under $79,000, you'll get your $613 a month, and the government will not take any of it back. But if you're making what's considered net income for tax purposes above $79,054, then they will claw back that monthly payment at a rate of 15%, so 15 cents for every dollar of income you make above that $79,000. So for all intents and purposes, based on the amount individuals would receive between January and March of 2020, you would get some of the OAS above $79,000, but it would be clawed back and it would completely disappear when you're making just above $128,000.
Right. So 70, call it in the mid-70s and in the mid-120s are the real milestone income amounts that a lot of retirees are trying to minimize. And I think this is a really appropriate question. What are some of the strategies that seniors could employ to reduce or eliminate that clawback?
Well, there are actually quite a few. So I'll list a few. Some are a little more obvious than others. So, for example, if you
don't report your income to the government and live off, you know, in the hidden black market economy, is that one that IG Wealth Management endorses? Probably.
That is not one that
okay,
I'm
okay. Just
list.
Checking. No. Just checking.
No. One is, however, because you can't receive OES until you're 65 years of age, you're probably going to receive your CPP or QPP benefits as well. And if you're receiving that and you have a spouse or common law partner, you can actually ask the government to split that between the two spouses. So if I was a higher income earner and I would receive more CPP than my spouse would, I could ask the government to kind of equalize those payments for the years that we've actually been together so that my CPP would be less and her CPP would be more. So if I'm receiving less of the income, I have less to report. And if we're into the clawback ranges, I am and she's not, then right. I can reduce my clawback without her having any negative impact. So it's all about trying to shift that income to the lower income spouse.
Right.
So you can do that with CPP and QPP. You can also do pension income splitting. Pension income splitting would be if you're receiving a government pension or an employer pension, or if you're at least 65 years of age and getting income from your registered retirement income fund, so your RIF or a locked-in LIF plan. That you don't ask the government to do. It's just when you file your tax return, if you're receiving some eligible income, you can actually split up to 50% of that income with your spouse, with your lower income spouse. And again, it's about trying to get the higher income spouse out of or at least reduce the clawback of the OAS without impacting the lower income spouse's clawback as well.
The mandatory RIF withdrawals are what get a lot of people really annoyed because it becomes, is there anything you can do on that front or is that just the reality of it? If you've built up a massive nest egg and you've got your minimum withdrawal, you may boot the OAS out of your income stream.
You may, but there's some planning you can do because for all intents and purposes, you have no choice but to start receiving RIF minimum payments after the year in which you turn 71 years of age, so starting at age 72 and beyond. There's a minimum you'll have to withdraw from your RIF. But a lot of people don't know or don't realize is that if you have a younger spouse or common law partner, you can base those minimums on the age of that spouse, not your own. So, for example, if I'm 72 years of age, I now have to withdraw a minimum amount from my RIF based on my age. If I have a 65-year-old spouse, I can base it on the – I can say I want my minimum based on the 65-year-old spouse, not 72-year-old individual. And the percentages are lower the younger you are. So my minimum would be less. And that will continue as long as I have that younger spouse. So I can ask that minimum be set at that age, and it will mean I will have to withdraw a lot less because of the younger spouse's age. So yes, you have to withdraw a minimum, but at the same time, you can ask that minimum be reduced.
Some entrepreneurs will be paying themselves in retirement through corporations, and some will choose to do that in the form of a dividend versus a salary. Does that change the dynamic?
It does because any dividend, any Canadian source dividend that's received by an individual is subject to what's considered a gross up. So if you receive a $1,000 dividend, whether it's from your own company or from owning publicly traded securities or mutual funds, you don't include $1,000 in your income. You actually include $1,000 plus the gross up. Mm. Now, the gross up depends on the type of dividend, but for example, eligible dividends, you have to gross it up by 38%. So my $1,000 dividend is no longer $1,000 that's reported on my tax return. It's actually $1,380. So even though cash is $1,000, I have to report more, and that clawback is based on that grossed up number. So dividend income, although tax preferred because you actually get a dividend tax credit, can be detrimental if you're receiving OAS benefits. So the strategy could be maybe pay yourself a salary from your business if that works better, or if you own publicly traded securities, stocks, mutual funds, explore with your advisor whether there are ways to invest that may minimize that dividend income and maybe have more growth if that fits in your portfolio better.
There's a lot of discussion about the value of financial advice. Aurel, I think you have proven that for retirees in particular, there's real value in having a second eye, especially on how you optimize benefits as a retiree. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Aurel Crissell, Assistant Vice President of Tax and Estate Planning at IG Wealth Management. He's here to talk about old age security and some strategies you might be able to use to minimize the clawback. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll talk to policy advisors Jitin Puri, and specifically, we'll take him through the Moolala questionnaire. But first, FP Canada's Carrie List will be here to talk about the decade ahead, what to expect in the financial advice industry. And I know one of the things people are talking a lot about is this idea of value and how to prove it. And don't forget, you can download segments and full episodes of this show on any of the podcast platforms, no matter where you get them from. While you're there, it would be so great if you gave us a rating, ideally a good one, but, you know, not necessarily. Write a quick review and subscribe so the next episode will arrive right onto your device. Hey, it also helps other people find us. So basically, you're doing your good deed for the day, and it took you like 4 seconds. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When you go to the dentist or the family doctor or the estate lawyer, you can be pretty confident that a certain standard of education in the field has been achieved. There are rules, there are requirements. Not so in the world of financial advice. Things are much more complicated. Carrie List is the president and CEO of FP Canada, and he joins us now as a part of our series called The Decade Ahead, What's Next for the Financial Advice Industry. Welcome.
Thank you, Bruce.
In two sentences, no more, what is FP Canada?
FP Canada is an organization that is dedicated to championing better financial health for all Canadians, and we do that through our certification programs and through education, CFP certification, QAFP certification, and financial education for prospective financial planners.
One of the biggest things you talk about is the notion of titles and how we talk about financial advisors and financial planners in this country. Why is that so important in your view?
It's critical because right now the onus of responsibility for figuring everything out is on the consumer, on the prospective client. Consumers don't understand the difference between what a financial advisor is, what a financial planner is, what an investment advisor is, what a portfolio manager is. And there are no rules, regulations, laws that dictate who can call themselves what. And there's no real clear definition of what those things are.
How do you think that is going to play out in the decade ahead? I think there's a certain amount of will and momentum in the marketplace. Certainly people like me would advocate for that kind of clarity for the health of the consumer. How do you think it's going to play out?
So FP Canada has been really advocating for restrictions in law as to who can call themselves what and for clearer definitions so consumers actually can make informed choices about whom they go to for what types of advice. We've been advocating for this for the better part of 10 years. We've seen some really significant movement in the last several months. And Ontario actually passed legislation in its budget bill this year in 2019. And it's now through a regulatory body to actually set the rules and regulations around that legislation. So that's happening in Ontario, and I think that's spurring on other provinces. It's provincial in nature, so unfortunately, we have to go province by province.
It's very complicated.
Especially when you're, it's a big country.
Yeah.
But we've seen legislation tabled in Saskatchewan and other provinces taking great interest. So I think, Bruce, if we're looking at the next decade, I'm very hopeful that, in fact, we're going to see legislation harmonized across the country in every province that restricts who can call themselves a financial planner or financial advisor or an investment advisor and helps define for the clients or prospective clients what those people are capable of doing so and what the services they offer so that consumers can make informed choices.
Do you think that will increase the number of people who follow your designation path? Or, I mean, it's a higher hurdle, right?
It is a higher hurdle. We're already seeing it, and it's very interesting in preparation for upcoming legislation, partly, also because we see that the financial services industry is recognizing it has to up its game. Mm. We're seeing a very dramatic increase in the number of students who are pursuing CFP certification, Certified Financial Planner certification, and we see that only growing. I think what we're going to find is people are either going to leave the industry if they were just selling product,
right,
or they're going to step up to a professional standard.
Technology is enormous. It's a huge theme. I was looking at the date of when the first robo announced its launch in the U.S. is around 2008 or so. So a shorter life here in Canada, but becoming a force. Robos started as this challenger, like, I'm going to change the game. And now some advisors are using that technology so that they can focus more on client service and more on financial planning. From where you sit, how do you think that theme's going to play out in the next 10 years?
This is one of the most fascinating developments in financial services, and I think in every profession worldwide. But you mentioned the first robo firm, what, 2008, I think you said. I think initially, it was really seen as a threat. Disruption immediately is this is a threat to our very existence. I think what happened, first thing that happened is all of these robo firms that thought they were going to put professional advisors or financial planners out of business realized that they couldn't go direct to consumers. They didn't. They hadn't earned the trust. Consumers didn't necessarily know what they were getting from technology. They weren't comfortable investing or getting advice from a computer. So there was a over the last, I'd say 4 years in particular, there's been a huge shift where these technology, we call them fintech firms, whether it's robo platforms or not, they've been looking at partnering with organizations like ours, with planners like CFP professionals and say, can we provide the backbone? Can we provide some of the services like selecting appropriate portfolios, helping rebalance portfolios, asset allocation? Can we do that for you? Mm. Take some of the heavy lifting off of your plate, and those are things technology can actually do better, and then leave the professional advice, which is really financial planning, helping their CFPs, for example, or financial planners and others, helping bring clarity and simplicity to really complex matters.
And humanity.
And that is what is left, really, for most professions, is that humanity. And very interesting, I think what we're seeing is a real 360. The advent of technology is actually driving more demand for the human connection because people are feeling they've lost it.
Right. Oh, interesting. Now, one of the other dynamics for folks with the CFP is which fee structure is going to work for them. And, you know, back in the day, it was commission-based. Now it's commission-based, fee-based, fee-only subscription, money coaches. There's like many, many different ones. What's the position of FP Canada on all this? Or do you try and remain agnostic and let it all sort itself out in the wash?
Well, agnostic to a certain extent. It's really important. Fee structure is only important, I think, from the perspective of, does the client know what they're paying? Do they know what they're paying for? Do they know what they should expect in return? Is there full transparency? Are there conflicts of interest? Is that all out in the open? And does the client actually have a choice as to how to pay for the services that they're getting? And I think the rest doesn't really matter. If it's fee, write a check, assets under administration, various other forms, as long as the client has choice. They know what they're paying for. They know what they're getting in return. They know that their planner, in this case, or advisor, is not conflicted. And that if they are conflicted, they're disclosing it. They've agreed to accept that. And that the advisor is always working in their client's best interest and is going to be held accountable for it.
Do you think that the current trends are going to continue?
I think they will, yeah.
So, i.e., more fee-based, less commission-based?
Yes, we're already seeing that, and we're seeing a normalization out there. The old DSC, deferred sales charge, the norm back in the day, you may remember, was like 8-9% deferred sales charges. The vast majority of advisors out there are working without deferred sales charges. And transparency has become a requirement now. So, I think we're going to see that trend continue.
We talk so much about the environment here in Canada. What are the countries that you look to that could be a precursor for where Canada will go in the next decade? Is it the U.S.? Is it Australia? Is it the U.K.? And if it's those three, what are some of the things that you watch that says that we need to be aware of this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think we have actually taken the lead around titling and title restriction. Hmm. We haven't seen an effective job being done in any of those three territories that you
really
talked about. But I think when it comes to regulation, when it comes to what the U.S. calls fiduciary, we call best interest standard, I think the U.S. really is the country that we should look to. They're the closest, most similar to ours in terms of their financial services system. Australia is a bit of a different animal, and I don't think we're going to see what's been happening in Australia coming to Canada, nor the U.K.
I want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
And it is this. What is your hope for the decade ahead? So clearly you're invested. This is your life's work. What is it that you hope for your organization and for the tens of thousands of people who work in this industry focused on delivering value for Canadians?
You know, I think it's twofold. I think one, from the side of the advisory community, we really hope that all people who hold themselves out to be professionals actually focus on the human side that you've talked about. Mm. Focus on the holistic side. Use technology to help them be better professionals. And, of course, we'd like to see them all get CFP certification. But I want to say just, Bruce, from the consumer side, we want to see consumers, clients, we want to see help to get them to understand what they really need and focus on the right type of advice, because there's just too much confusion out there in the marketplace.
Here's to that. Gary, right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce.
Gary List, President and CEO of FP Canada. Now, as I mentioned, this interview is one in a multi-part series called The Decade Ahead. What's next for the financial services industry? You can find the other segments on our website, moolala.ca. Pull down the Buy Media tab and then go to podcasts. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money and a little bit about life. We have been having this conversation since the show started more than 100 episodes ago, which is insane. It is really interesting to hear what people say. Our guest today is Jiten Puri. He is CEO of Policy Advisor. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. How would you describe your money personality?
Bruce, I'm a risk taker.
You're a risk taker.
I am.
Okay. Has it always been that way?
You know, it has been, at least over the last decade. Some of the personal investing and professional choices I've made make that fairly evident. I gave up a fairly stable and highly remunerative investment banking profession to become an entrepreneur, and that speaks to it. And from an investing perspective as well, as I dabble into opportunities where I could generate returns, I do take risks that I would say are not necessarily the right thing for everyone.
If I were to talk to 16-year-old Jiten, what would he have said?
16-year-old would have said, go build a career first.
Go build a career first. Okay, so you were responsible, you were a good boy, and then
that's what I did.
The dice.
And that's what I did.
Right.
I ended up working in financial services for close to two decades now. That helped bring about some financial
security.
You're
now a risk taker.
I am a risk taker.
Who was your money mentor growing up, would you say?
You know, it's been various people that I have had the opportunity to work alongside. I was a private banker as well, helping manage money for some of the largest and very successful high net worth families out of Asia. And so just watching what they were doing and what they were not doing just helped me get some very close association with opportunities that existed.
You spent some time living in Manhattan. I have spent time living in Manhattan. What is one of your guiltiest spending pleasures? Doesn't have to be about New York, but I mean, come on.
You know, living right in the middle of Manhattan. That
right.
was my guiltiest spending pleasure.
Right. And this was a practical reason too. So you could go from your desk to your bed in under 4 minutes.
Absolutely. You know, I kept really long working hours, as you can imagine, being an investment banker. And I did not want to be a hop, skip and roll away.
Yeah.
And that's where I was.
Okay.
I was...
What about now? What about what do you spend on that some people would say, Jiten, come on, really?
Last minute travels.
Okay. Where have you been in the last 3 years that would fit the bill?
I travel a lot to Asia. Besides being home, you know, it's also a fantastic part of the world that is that people in North America have been less exposed to.
How many stars? Did investment banking make you used to 5-star only? Can you bear something that's at least a 4? No. You should see his facial expression, listeners. He's got a grin from ear to ear, but he knows I've got his number. He can no longer stay in a 4-star hotel.
I am able to make choices depending on where I need to be, who I need
like,
to see.
Who's listening to this interview? Who's listening to this? What was your worst financial mistake?
Not buying property in Manhattan.
Renting.
Renting through what has been a terrific property cycle in the U.S.
Do you own in Toronto or Vancouver?
I do.
You own in Toronto?
Own a few properties in Toronto.
What's your buy in Toronto?
2015 onwards.
Okay, 2005 would have been better.
Would have been a lot better. I was still building a career then. So.
What is one financial behavior you would say you're still working on, or are you perfect? That was a joke. He didn't even smile. He's like, yeah, empirically, I am perfect, but let me find. So it's like you're doing a job interview and someone asks you what your weaknesses are, and you're like, I'm too committed. I work too hard.
Right. Bruce, I would say just continuing to systematically invest. I do that off and on. Work takes over and then I forget to do that. But just staying invested for the long term and continuously, systematically, just following a rule and continuing to invest does generate good returns over the long term.
What is one thing you worry about when it comes to money?
That I'm not doing enough with it.
That you're not maximizing the returns.
Absolutely, yes.
What is one money topic that you could talk about, read about, engage in all day, every day? You just love it.
Insurance, financial protection.
You didn't even hesitate.
Exactly.
Really?
I realize that all of us as individuals, greed is a bigger incentive for all of us. And we all look at investing more than we look at financial protection. And as I turned an entrepreneur and as insurance started to get closer to my heart, I've realized that I need to educate others about the benefits of financial protection, focusing on protection at least as much as we all focus on greed.
Do you buy insurance on products that you buy at a store like Best Buy?
I do now, having broken my iPhone 3 times in the last 1 year, which takes it off Apple Care. I now do.
You now, okay. But the question is, it's a serious question, is I absolutely am on the same page with you when it comes to insurance as protection against calamity, without a doubt, absolutely 1,000%. There are so many insurance products out there that are, if not ridiculous, then bordering on ridiculous, like final expense insurance, pet insurance, and you can debate it, but it's not to protect against calamity. Where do you fall on that spectrum of the risk of over-insuring and some of the stuff that you buy at the till, which is truly ridiculous?
See, I would say it really depends on the value of the purchase. And that's what I look at. What's at risk? What's at loss? How much is that loss? Can I bear that? Absorb that loss? If I'm buying a high ticket item, then I would consider getting a product warranty on it. If it's a lower ticket, travel insurance, I would get. But flight insurance, flight interruption, flight cancellation, right, it's not something I can deal with, so I wouldn't.
I'm a risk taker with my phone. I'm just going to be careful with it, unlike you. Just kidding. Jitin, thank you very much. Jitin Puri, the CEO of Policy Advisor, and that is the Moolala Questionnaire. That is our show for today. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by EQ Bank, banking simplified. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to the podcast too? You can get in touch with me on social media, Twitter at Bruce Selry or Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. I'm also the money columnist for a TV show called City Line, which is syndicated across North America. Those segments are all online at cityline.tv. Then search for me. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a great day.